2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andreas Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at kslpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
Today on First Lady and Friends, we had a conversation with Amy Antonelli, the CEO of Humanitarian Experience. She has an amazing story about her time with Steve Jobs, her time at Facebook, and really starting this incredible nonprofit. She took us through some incredible life experiences. I can't wait for you to take a listen. Let's get proximate. We're back here on First Lady and Friends with Amy Antonelli, the CEO. Really excited about this episode. We have Amy Antonelli, the CEO of Humanitarian Experience, Inc. We are really excited to have you here today, Amy. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. What an honor to be here.
You have such a fascinating story, and you and I have connected because my kids have gone on trips with the organization, and you know, it has a different name, so yeah. I have to get used to the new name. HXB is the organization, and honestly, it has been life-changing for my kids. So I'm so excited to have this conversation. But let's, before we get into all that, I want to go back and let's just talk about where you grew up and a little bit of experience in your early childhood and your early years.
Oh, well, thank you so much. First of all, I am so thrilled to hear that your kids had a great experience. I feel like I have so much respect for you and what you're doing, and I'm so glad that I was able to add to what you're already doing with your kids. But I think there's probably no greater compliment that I could ever hear than, you know, or my team could ever hear than just to hear that kids really went on these things and felt like they were different afterwards. They came out better.
You know, it's interesting. With my kids, it was... There was an age change in the missionary for the LDS church, for the missionaries. And I had this moment where I just, my boys were, you know, elementary, middle school age. And I remember thinking, oh my goodness, like, I don't know why just like 1 year, and it wasn't like they had to go a year early or anything like that. Yeah. But I just had this moment as a parent where it was like, I just feel this pressure to prepare my kids. You know, if that's the choice they made, and you know, to make sure that they were prepared to make that choice to serve a mission and to be prepared just on a maturity level, and so I just, that's where I started to look for something that could help them, and that's when I found this organization. As I was thinking about, like, they need some experiences away from home. They need some experiences like without me there. That will help prepare them for, you know, whatever it is, the whatever choices they make. But having those, that little bit of independence from me, having the opportunity to serve people that are different from them and get to know their stories, like, to me, that it was just a perfect organization for my kids. And it just, like, hit me at that time when this was so important to me.
Oh, that's so good to hear. I feel like this generation of kids, probably more than any generation in history, has this challenge that they're facing right now, where these kids really have to kind of do the work earlier than it feels like anybody else has had to do to truly understand who they are and who they, you know, were created to become. And I think that if they don't do that work early on, like in their teenage years, then I think they're so susceptible to whatever really smart, logical argument comes along that tells them to be this sort of person or that sort of person. But there's so many voices coming at them right now. I think there's some statistic I read that says that on average, we look at our phones 366 times every day. And if you think about that, that's a voice that comes at you 366 times a day that's pulling you in one direction or another. And I just feel like if you don't sort of take some intentional time, and for a lot of these kids, that means putting their phones down and like stepping outside of their world and just going somewhere else where their entire focus is helping someone else. And somehow in that process, they start to understand more about their true identity and who they really are. And then they start to think, wait, is my current trajectory consistent with who I want to actually end up with? And it's mind-blowing how many of them will come home from those trips different. And I have so many parents that say to me, like, what are you doing out there? Like, how did this happen? And I'm like, I don't know. We decided to go build a school and they spent 2 weeks laying bricks and it changed their lives. But what I really think it is just, I think the greatest challenge they have is finding the headspace to just really be able to consider this stuff. And somehow when they go out on these trips for, you know, 17 days, they find that space to be able to really understand in a way they never have before who they are.
Yeah, it's so powerful. Let's go back to what inspired you. How did you get here?
Totally.
I mean, how did you get to where you are? And let's talk about those early years.
Yeah, no, it's such a random story. I think I was actually having lunch with someone today and I just said, I think if I was one of my trip leaders that I was having lunch with who's, you know, 22 years old right now. And I think if somebody would have told me when I was 22 where I would end up today, I would have thought they were up in the night.
Right? I think that's most of us. Yeah. I think we all have that moment where we're like, I would have not put me here.
Yeah. No, I grew up thinking that I would be a stay-at-home mom. That was my dream. And to be honest, I still have a little bit of a dream that someday I'll be able to have a family and focus entirely on that. But I believe so deeply that every single one of us has, I've heard it called a customized curriculum for our lives. And I think that part of why I'm so passionate about giving these kids space to be able to tap into who they are is because I think if we really can understand that we have a unique path and each one of us has a unique path, that we'll be able to kind of get started on that earlier. And hopefully people won't have to make as many mistakes as I did along the way. But I thought I would be a stay-at-home mom. And so I went to BYU with that intention, went on a mission, came home, got engaged. Everything was going, you know, as planned. And about 4 weeks before we were supposed to get married, we both felt like it was just wasn't the right thing. And so took off the ring, gave it back. And, right around that same time, I had a good friend who was starting, a company up in California. And he called me and said, hey, this thing came out while you were gone on your mission called the internet. And I really think it's going to be big. And he's like, that's a joke that only people from our generation understand. When I give that joke to 20-year-olds, they look at me very blankly.
Yeah, no, it's so true. Yeah. It's so true. Yeah. I tell stories about when I, you know, was trying to finish my degree in student teaching and sending videotapes back to my professor.
Yes.
And I'm like, the internet was just starting to be a thing. It's crazy.
Totally. But anyway, I had no idea what the internet was or really anything about technology, but I had started to learn to really follow that inner voice. And so it felt right. And so I decided to go. And we spent 2 years kind of building the consummate startup story. You know, we rented extra apartment space and sat on the floor because we didn't have furniture and made business plans. And, you know, I flew all over the country telling people about the internet. And 2 years later, I looked up and a guy walked into our office that I didn't recognize. And that will tell you how naive I was. It was Steve Jobs. Apple ended up acquiring our little startup. And so as part of that acquisition, I was invited to go to Cupertino. And I was invited to be one of the spokeswomen for Steve Jobs. Oh, let me just be clear.
That
sounds
wild.
Way sexier than it really was.
It's pretty wild if you think about it.
It's a very cool title for, like, I was pretty low level at Apple.
But early.
Yeah, but what the opportunity did give me was the chance to watch Steve Jobs, who I believe is, you know, obviously one of the greatest marketers in the world, bring Apple back. And so, you know, back then, you remember Apple was just in schools, like nobody knew what it was. But he had just come back to Apple and he had this belief that we were about to change the world. And it was contagious. I mean, you would go into meetings with this guy and it would be about a hard drive or something. And you would walk out being like, Apple is so lucky that I am here. It's like, because he made every single person there feel like, you know, like they had something to contribute that was important and that was critical to the success of what we were building as a whole. And I just watched him do this over and over and over while we worked so hard to kind of make this dream of his a reality. And it taught me so much about what we're capable of doing if we really engage people around a common cause. And so that was exciting. And I was living in Palo Alto and driving this cool little white convertible, and like Google and Apple and Facebook, everything was coming up at the time. So it was a really exciting time to be in Palo Alto. But I was having this experience where I was feeling a little bit pulled in opposite directions, because on the one hand, I was like living this really exciting, you know, wildlife and felt like the world was changing and we were in the epicenter of the hurricane. But on the other hand, I still had this inherent sort of feeling that I wanted to live a different life, and this was off from the path that I was wanting to follow. And I felt like there was a choice A and a choice B, but there was no other choice. And that's like a recipe for depression, you know, because I think when you're in that situation, and I didn't have the choice to be a stay-at-home mom at that point, but it felt like, on the other hand, I didn't really want to be like super tough, hardcore, like mean, you know, what I sort of created to be the ideal career woman at that point. And I couldn't see any other choice. And so I started to become a little bit depressed, I think. And I've learned in my life that when that starts to happen, you really have to kind of tap into that feeling and look for this choice C, because there's almost always a choice C in that situation. And for me, it happened when the 2004 tsunami hit Southern Asia and just wiped out the coast of Thailand and India and, you know, Sri Lanka. All of those thousands of people died. It was a horrible tragedy. But I had a mentor, Dick Peary, and he had a family foundation. And 5 days after the tsunami hit, I found myself on an airplane headed to India with his foundation to see what we could do to help. And while I was there, I found that the people, you know, affected by the tsunami were very well taken care of. But I was taken by a woman named Becky Douglas into a leprosy colony. And she was a housewife from Atlanta who was just kind of trying to figure out what she could do to help. And so she took me to a leprosy colony, and I thought, yeah, this will be interesting. And I drove out in this van with her. And I remember opening the door and getting out. And I had seen, you know, poverty in my life. I had seen different aspects of it. I'd never seen anything like a leprosy colony. Mm-hmm. Have you ever seen one?
No, I have not. I had a sister that they went to India, her and her husband. Her husband's a doctor, and through the program that they did. So I've seen pictures and I've heard stories from her.
Oh, yeah. So you're familiar with. I'd never seen anything like it. It was the most horrific thing I'd ever seen. I mean, like people sitting on the dirt with, you know, disfigured bodies and open wounds and human excrement and flies. And it was as close to what I imagine, you know, hell would be like as anything I'd ever experienced. And all I wanted to do was just turn around and get back in the car. Like I just couldn't even stand it to be there. But I had this moment literally as I was turning around to get back in the car where I made eye contact with this woman. And she was, I mean, maybe 80 pounds, tiny, tiny. And she was kind of sitting against a tree, and she didn't really have hands left. So she had kind of claws for arms. She was just sitting there, and she kind of looked at me, and I looked at her, and just in this split second, I just saw a woman that was, you know, just like me. And, but for an accident of birth, I could be there and she could be in my situation. And it just changed my whole perspective. All of a sudden, I didn't see anything else. I just saw her. And so I went over there, and in broken English, we started to talk to each other. And she told me her story. In India, for thousands of years, leprosy has been considered like a curse from God. And so if you contracted leprosy, they had very strict laws in place in India where really your only option to survive was to become a beggar on the streets. And they were treated horrifically. There was actually a law on the books until about 15 years ago where if a person affected with leprosy's shadow crossed yours, then you were within your rights to attack that person and beat them because they had essentially defiled you. And wow. I mean, and I think what I realized when I was sitting there talking to this woman, her name was Sarai, she was telling me that story, and I just all of a sudden started to think, what would it have been like to experience that, you know? And at one point, just in a very natural gesture of kind of like sister human compassion, I just like put my arm on her shoulder or my hand on her shoulder and just said, like, I'm so sorry. Like, I can't even imagine. And the reaction that she gave me, even when I tell this story, I still think about it. I still can like picture the look on her face because it was visceral. Mm-hmm. Like, she had so internalized this idea that she was untouchable that when I put my hand on her shoulder, she was stunned. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, my life totally changed. And I think her life changed too. And all of a sudden, my dumb convertible in Palo Alto meant nothing, because I could realize, like, in an instant, okay, I just spent, you know, 2 years learning from the best in the world how to engage people around a common cause, and he did it around a box. And so I think I can teach people about leprosy. I think I can help engage people. I think I can help solve this problem. Mm-hmm. And so I quit my job. I went home and quit my job and moved to India, as most normal, rational people would do.
Of course.
And I ended up living in India for the next 7 years, building this organization called Rising Star Outreach to help the leprosy-affected people in India. And that was an incredible experience where I really learned what it was like to impact people's lives in ways that, you know, dramatically actually change them. At one point, PBS did a documentary on our work, and it won the Gracie Award that year for the best documentary of the year. And so all of a sudden, it was playing all over America, and we just had volunteers that were, like, showing up. It was like Field of Dreams, like, if you build it, you know? Yeah, and I was like, what am I going to do with all these volunteers? And to be honest, I learned a lot of lessons. I remember just making up stupid jobs for them to do, and they were all frustrated because everybody just wants to contribute. Everybody just wants to matter and make an impact. And when people go all that way and then they don't, they feel frustrated about it. And so I kind of, over the course of 7 years, really understood that if you can create a program where people can actually contribute and add value to whatever it is that they're doing, you not only change the lives of the people that you're serving, but the people who come and who actually make a real difference go home different after that.
You know, that it's such a powerful story because, first of all, I mean, it's so inspiring, but it's also really critical. I love what you talked about. You know, we talk about this in service a lot with my organization. What we're doing is, like, people need to fill a purpose. And it's critical not to just sort of make it up. We know when it's not being useful, and it's kind of a waste of human power to do that. So yeah. I love that. I love that inspiration. And I can't wait to talk about what came next, and we'll do that when we come right back.
2 years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
There's desperation and anguish.
More than 80,000 Afghans have since arrived in America, but this story is still unfolding. I'm Andrea Martin. In my new podcast, Stranger Becomes Neighbor, we'll find out what happens to these new arrivals in our communities. Who would help our newest neighbors? Follow us at KSLpodcast.com, Apple Podcasts, or anywhere else you listen.
Let's continue down this path and this story. So you're in India. You're learning a lot of lessons about what makes a good nonprofit or what makes a good experience for people that are trying to serve. Where do you go from there?
Yeah. Well, it was an incredible experience. I mean, honestly, truly some of the happiest 7 years of my life, just driving a Jeep through the bush in India and just, like, seeing the people that have been so affected by leprosy for so many generations actually start to become self-reliant, and watching these children that are coming out of the colonies who were the, you know, destined to be the next generation of leprosy beggars on the streets of India. And now they are learning computers and they're learning English and they are getting, you know, they're going to college. And it's fun now. I mean, it's 25 years later and they're actually teachers and doctors and computer scientists, and they were going to be the next generation of leprosy beggars. And all of these people, all of these volunteers that showed up, like, changed their stars. And I'm grateful for that, and I'm proud of that. And I think that was a combination of people who came and people in India coming together and recognizing that there was a population who were in a situation where they couldn't actually change unless outsiders came in to kind of help change that. And so we learned a lot about them, we lived with them, and we understood them enough to understand what they needed. And then enough people decided to help. So it was an incredible experience, one that I'll truly always be grateful for. But remember, my personal thread is that I kind of wanted to be a stay-at-home mom and I wanted to raise children, right? So it was, believe it or not, it was actually hard to get a date in the leprosy colonies. And so, I'm still sort of going away from what I think my personal goal is here, you know? And 7 years later, I'm starting to finally feel like I like building things a lot, a little bit more than I like running them, I've learned. Mm. And so after 7 years, we feel like we'd built Rising Star to a point where it was ready to get run, and people that have, you know, taken over the organization now have done an amazing job with it. I still sit on the board, but I'm not involved in the day-to-day anymore, and I'm so proud of what it's become. But personally for me, I felt like it was time to kind of move to the next step. And so I applied to Harvard, which was a pipe dream in any kind of universe before that. But I had a great, you know, a great experience that I think was good enough to kind of say, look, she's lived in India. She's really understands this population. And so the Kennedy School for Social Impact was like an obvious next place to go. And so I spent a year there really studying the best nonprofits and the best philanthropists and hearing about people that were making an impact all over the world. And I just soaked it all up. It was just such an unbelievable experience to be there and to learn from all those people. And right at the end, when I was about to graduate, I got a call from a friend at Facebook who said, listen, Mark Zuckerberg is really frustrated because Mark has created an organization that he believes is going to change the world. Mark fundamentally believes that if the 2/3 of the world who don't have access to healthcare or finance or education can see each other and connect with each other as human beings, that they will become more than numbers and will be able to make a difference in the world. And obviously for me, I immediately think of my story with Sarai. I'm like, oh yeah, that happened. Before that, all I saw was like the awfulness of the leprosy colony, but I saw a person and I connected with a person and it changed my whole life and it changed her life too. And so, my friend who worked at Facebook said, Mark wants somebody to come to Facebook to help redefine that for the internal community at Facebook. He wants everybody who works at Facebook to really understand what it is that Facebook's about. Because at that point, Facebook is a wild experience. I mean, like there's like, I'm sure you've been there, but there's like 5 restaurants on campus and all the best, you know, chefs in the world. And there's like Bose headphones that you can just get by swiping your card in the vending machine, and they do your laundry and they do your dry cleaning for free. And there's, wow. I mean, there's like literally they were paying me the salary and I couldn't figure out what to spend the money on.
Because they paid for everything else too.
It was an amazing
That's wild.
But Mark was so frustrated because he spent years like sleeping on an air mattress building this thing, and people were complaining because the valets weren't parking their cars fast enough, you know, and his head was kind of exploding. And so when that got presented to me, I just thought, yeah, I'm actually totally ready to take this job. I understood what Silicon Valley is like. I came up in Apple, and then I've seen the other side of it and what actually it can do for people when they feel like they're driven by a cause that's bigger than themselves. And I think I can go and do this and I can help. And so I went to Facebook and I had 15 interviews. The last two were, you know, a long interview with Sheryl Sandberg and the long interview with Mark Zuckerberg. And I got the notice that I'd been hired, and it was like greatest day of my life. I was so excited. There was one weird interview that I had among all of the 15, and it was a vice president who just was, you know, sometimes I think women are so good for each other. Some of my best mentors have been women, and some are just hard. Mm-hmm. So if you're a woman and you're listening to this, please decide you're going to be the woman that supports other women.
We second that thought. Yes.
Just instantly, I could tell that she was going to do whatever she could to thwart me. And so I came on and I just loved it. I started building this idea that everybody at Facebook had a purpose and a reason to be there, and we could move the needle on whatever it was that you personally cared about by using the platform of Facebook to do that. So if your thing was, I don't know, like the homeless community or something, you could actually, I don't think there's anything better than Facebook. LinkedIn comes close, but doesn't come nearly as powerfully as Facebook did at that time to actually move the needle on something. And so I spent 6 months just building this huge collaborative effort to really change the feeling of the population at Facebook. While I was at Harvard, I had gotten into the habit of recording all of my classes. Mm. And so while I was at Facebook, I would do that, just record all my meetings. I'm a little anal in some ways. And so like, I have to like record it and then go back and listen to it to make sure I got it all. But you know, at the end of 6 months, we had this really powerful meeting with Mark Zuckerberg, Sheryl Sandberg, all of the Chris Cox, all the leaders of Facebook. And I kind of presented what my team had been doing. And it was a great meeting. I was so excited. I got an email from Sheryl Sandberg that night saying like, wow, amazing job. You did such a great job. And I like came out on such a high. It was like a great pinnacle of my career. And then the next day, the administrative assistant of this vice president asked me a question about the meeting. And I said, oh, I don't know, but I recorded the meeting so I can go back and check. And within 3 hours, I was fired from Facebook. I'd been walked out the door. In California, it is completely against the law to record people, first of all, without their knowledge. And second, it was Mark Zuckerberg. Like, I could have sold that recording to the New York Times for $1 million. I did it so innocently that I didn't think about the repercussions of what it was, but it was the dumbest move of my career. I mean, like, I think, and to be honest, I think anybody else probably would have said, don't ever do that again and kind of let me go. But this woman who hated my guts, I was like, I handed her the opportunity.
Wow.
So I remember I was sitting there having been fired, sitting in my car thinking like, oh my gosh, my life is about to be destroyed. And I was supposed to speak to the student body at BYU Idaho in like 2 weeks. And all of a sudden I thought, I can't believe I've been fired. And then the second thought was, what am I going to tell these students? I'm supposed to be the super high level executive at Facebook and I've just been fired, you know? So I spent a week hiding under the covers and then I started to write this talk and I wrote about 40 versions of it that skirted around what had happened. And finally, the night before I was supposed to give it at like 3 o'clock in the morning, I rewrote the talk and my best friend flew out from Denver. She sat in the wings of the audience. I put a Bose headphone in my ear and covered it with my hair. And then I put the microphone on the other side of it. And my friend read me the talk in my ear as I gave it on the stage to the student body at BYU Idaho.
Wow.
And this is what I said. I walked out on the stage and I said, imagine you woke up on the day before your 40th birthday, having just been fired from a great job at Facebook. And you had to speak to the students, to the entire student body about how to find your purpose in life. And I paused after that. I remember hearing like, wait, what did she say? What did she just say?
Did she say fired?
Yeah. And then I said, you know, to be honest, I don't know what's next for me, but I do know this. I've learned in my life so far that finding our purpose is never a one-time event. Like we do this over and over and over. And I really meant it when I said it on that stage. I really believed that whatever it was that was next for me was very much in the cards and was going to be important. And while I lost $1 million when I got fired from Facebook, and while that had just happened and felt like the most devastating thing that had ever happened in my career, I just knew that something else was happening. It was such a powerful experience. And, you know, I mean, fast forward now a decade later and the miracles that I've seen working at HXP have been something that I would have paid way more than $1 million now to have experienced. I think God knew me really well when that happened.
That's such a powerful story because I think most of us, I'm like you. I mean, I had a plan. You have this is what you're going to do. This is what your life's going to look like. I right now, my 16-year-old, we talk about like, things are going to change. Things are going to, things are going to morph and change. And there are things that are going to happen in your life that you think are devastating.
Totally.
That you think have just, the whole plan is out of whack when really that was the plan.
Yes.
And you just didn't know it. And I love that lesson for young people. I love that you were able to, to convey that to young people at BYU. And I hope everybody, hears that. And even I think like at my age, it's still important to hear.
Totally.
Spencer and I were having this conversation not too long ago about like, when this is all over,
yeah.
When what we're doing now is all over, like then what?
What next?
You know, and I was thinking, I'm like, I don't know. Cause I was a special education teacher. Do I teach? Do I not?
Right.
What comes next
right.
for me? I don't know. And we'll worry about that when it comes. But I think always there's just always
I think when we look back in life, we start to see those markers. It's really, you don't see them when you're facing forward. You always see them, I think, when you look back and kind of see those markers along the way that pivoted you to different places.
Totally. Steve Jobs always said that it's only in retrospect that you can connect the dots. But I hear what you're saying. I feel like a lot of my friends in this position right now are thinking, you know, their kids are kind of all getting ready to go out of the home and they think, wait, hold on. I actually have a lot to contribute still. And I want to do more. And I don't feel like my life is done now. In just this phase of my life is done now. And I just love that concept that it kind of frees us. The idea that we have a purpose that we find over and over and over, it kind of frees us to think, okay, cool. What's my next purpose? Maybe it's not leprosy in India anymore. Maybe it's something else, and maybe it's something else, and maybe when this thing is done, it's something else. But I think until the day we die, there's purpose that we have to continue to seek for and look for. And so for me, that was really important that I recognize that. And it's actually probably the fundamental principle that I have used to build HXP over the last 10 years. It goes back to what I said at the beginning, that we have to understand who we are fundamentally and our inherent value. Mm-hmm. Because when we understand that, these things that most people would consider devastating, you know, I got fired. I went out in a dumpster fire. I didn't just get fired. I got fired by Mark Zuckerberg and I lost $1 million, you know, but truly like that, because I feel like I'd done the work at that point to understand, okay, this is not going to define my life. It opened me up for, you know, for what HXP has become. And it also allowed me to think, wow, all that time I spent at Harvard learning about responsible humanitarianism and like what that looks like, not to just go into a place and build a well, but to do the research first, to understand what's the economic, what's the social, what's the environmental impact of what we're going to do, allows me and my team to really create responsible organizations, responsible projects, so that we're not just sending kids haphazardly to 52 locations all over the world. We do it in a way that's really conscious and really, really careful, so that we're actually adding value in real ways to the people we're going to serve. My worst nightmare is for a kid to have felt like this was a life-changing experience and then be sitting in a college classroom 5 years and learn about volunteerism or something like that and think, oh my gosh, everything I did was a waste. Like, it's not. I believe as Christians, I believe as human beings, that we have a responsibility to help people where we can, regardless of where we come from or the color of our skin or anything else. I think we have a responsibility to serve each other and help each other and lift each other up. And if we can do that in ways where we can do as much good and as little harm as possible, then I think that's just our job as humans.
It's a great model, and you know, one that I, again, as clearly you've put so much not just thought but actual research and data behind it. And really those empirical stories about how the best type of nonprofits, the best type of help, we hear sort of the white savior complex, yeah. and you don't want that. And like you said, like sometimes you start to think, well, am I doing the best good? Truthfully, you know, as I hear your story, I think I'm guessing Mark Zuckerberg probably thinks he made a big mistake because
Facebook
has become.
Yeah.
Not that there's not good things about it, but I personally have had to get off it.
The privacy scandal wasn't lost on me.
Yes, exactly. So, I'm going to say that he probably made a big mistake, but I want to get really into the program. Let's do that when we come right back. Welcome back to First Lady and Friends. This has been such a great podcast. I'm just thrilled with it. So many great stories, so many great experiences and lessons in life. I just think it's powerful. And I think our conversation off mic is probably better than what we're doing on mic. So we're going to try to talk about humanitarian experience. But your story is so incredible. I'm so happy you shared that with us. But let's talk about, again, we talked a little bit at the beginning. It's a powerful experience for young people. I'm sure it's gone through some changes and a ton of growth. So let's start maybe where it started, you know, and maybe where it's where we are now.
Yeah, for sure. It's such a cool story, actually. It actually, this is our 25th year. It actually started 25 years ago. Yeah. It was started by a couple named Glenn and Elizabeth Bingham. The story is that they had a son who was, you know, kind of a typical teenager. They were a well-off family. They lived on the East Coast. And one day their son came to them and said, here's a list of cars that I would be willing to drive. And they decided in that moment that they had failed as parents. And so they talked about it. They're very smart and intentional people. I just love both of them so much. And they decided that really what their son David needed was a totally different perspective change. And so Glenn had served his mission in Brazil, and he just decided in that moment that he was going to take David and go down and spend the summer in Brazil building a home for street kids. And so that was the first HXP edition. It was never meant to be this multi-million dollar global nonprofit. It was really the result of two parents that loved their son and they wanted to make a difference for him. And so, you know, David came back that year, totally different person. And it was hard to ignore that. And their friends started to notice it And it just kind of started to organically grow that way. And the Binghams were really running it themselves for a long time. Glenn would take an expedition somewhere, and then Elizabeth would take an expedition somewhere. And they have amazing stories of that first decade or so of just kind of like building it out with no marketing or anything, just people hearing about it and wanting it to affect their kids' lives the way it had affected everybody else's. And Glenn started after about 10 years to hire people. He would hire really smart kids that were coming out of Harvard for the first time. He would pay them some crazy small amount of money, and they would give their whole hearts and souls to it and build it for a couple more years. And then he would hire somebody else. And that went on for about, you know, a good handful of years, and till it finally got to the point where they had so many people on the waiting list that the Binghams realized, we really can't do this anymore, just as kind of a family run endeavor. Like, we have to kind of turn this over. And kudos to them, which I think is the hardest thing in the world to do. They literally did turn it over. I mean, you hear about founder syndrome and how, you know, you can't let go of it. And when Glenn and Elizabeth hired me, they said, we're going to let you run this and we're going to trust you to do it. And they pick up the phone anytime I call. And I'm so grateful for that, because they're really wise counselors. But when they hired me, when they went and found me through our alumni database, and, you know, I first came on and thought that was a cute little thing and I would gonna help them out a little bit. And within a few weeks, I just thought, you know what? This is the thing. This is what I was talking about on the stage. This is the reason that I was fired, because that feeling that I had talked about back in Palo Alto of like wanting to nourish, wanting to love, wanting to be a mother is something that I still had after all those years. And all of a sudden I recognized I just spent so much time, first of all, getting these phones in these kids' hands, and then at Facebook, getting them to look at their phone all the time. And I don't want that for them. What I want is for them I need them to understand that even if you get fired, even if you lose $1 million, you are worth more than any kind of outside definer. And I don't want social media. I don't want this technology that's constantly coming at you to define who you are. And it took me a couple of weeks to realize that HXP was the answer for that. And so I sort of see HXP as my penance for for my time in Silicon Valley. But honestly, that's what it was. I think there were three of us back there in the office. It was 9 years ago now that I first started. And there was, I think, around 1,000 kids that were going on trips. And really, like, it's a startup story all over again. You know, I had really smart people that were working there and a lot of volunteers that would come and help us. And we just slowly, slowly started to grow it and invite people to come and help. And a lot of really smart people came and added their page to this story. And then what was happening originally with David continued to happen, where kids would go on trips and they would come back different. Either, you know, they were sort of veering off into kind of weird, you know, rebellious places, or they were just kind of really sad because they'd been twisted up in terms of their value and where that was coming from. And they would come home and they would be different. And I, there's one story that I always talk about. When kids really have a hard time on our trips, we always make a note of it in our little system in case they want to come back again, because I want to know that they're coming back for the right reasons, that they really are into it. I'm not really in the business of forcing people to do stuff. And so, you know, one year during registration week, we had a girl try and sign up, and her name was flagged from the year before. And so I called her parents and I just said, how's she doing? You know, she struggled a little bit last year. And her dad said, let me just tell you a story. He's like, when my daughter went on that trip last year, he said she'd been so bullied before she went on her trip that we completely lost her. She was so dark and so sad. And she went on that trip with so many walls up because she didn't believe that she had any value at all. And it's kind of the same thing as that story of the woman in the leprosy colony. I don't really know what happens in that moment when we as humans touch each other and connect with each other, but there's magic in that, you know, and that idea of like loving God and loving people and that truth that we feel when our spirits connect is so powerful. And he said, I don't really understand what happened, but he said she struggled a lot at the beginning of the trip. And then slowly, he said, the kids, I don't know if it's the kids that were kind to her and like truly loved her, or if it's the impact that she made when she was out there meeting the local people and serving them and being kind to them. But he said, we went to the airport to pick her up. And he said, as soon as we saw her coming down the escalator, he said, we had our daughter back. We knew we had our daughter back. And that story makes me cry every time because I just think, yeah, I don't know who's running this thing, but it's not me. You know what I mean? Like somebody said to me the other day, does it just feel like you're conducting this beautiful symphony of, you know, all these thousands of kids all over the world and all of these people that are serving and being served and just must feel amazing. I was like, yeah, that's kind of a good analogy. But then I thought, you know, what it actually feels like is I'm standing on a platform, like waving my arms around, and there's somebody standing behind me who's like so actually much more knowledgeable and so much more wise and really understands who these kids are, that's really like building this thing. And, you know, regardless of your faith background or your place in your journey in terms of understanding who you are, I think there's real power in just letting yourself completely love another human and serving them and in the process coming to know who you are as a result.
Well, and I think too, you know, I've had powerful experiences and I always want this for my kids to get, I mean, you have to get proximate. You have to get close to somebody. Oh, cool. You have to see them in their face. You have to look eye to eye. Like there's something about physical proximity, like, You can look at people from afar and say, well, I can, you know, give money, or that you know, that story on TV is really heartbreaking. But like you said, there's this human to human connection that has to take place, I think, for our hearts to really be changed and touched by another person.
Oh my gosh, I love that concept. I love how you say it, like that proximity, that human proximity. I think, you know, that's the problem with like these virtual solutions. We saw this during COVID, right? There's these virtual solutions and we think we're connecting, but there's something about in real life happening in this moment where we're just like sitting in a room talking to each other and you can feel each other's spirits. It's so powerful.
Yeah. So I mean, all that aside, because that's the big thing, but just logistically, you guys are adding, because when I was just trying to do the math in my head. I think our oldest did a trip. He went to Bolivia.
Oh, that's such a great trip.
I want to say it was 2015 or 16. Mm. So he was 15, I believe. And so it was probably 2015.
Wow.
That he was there. And so that was not too long after you.
No, it was the year before. It sounds like I took over in 2016, so it was right there. Yeah,
so it was close to that time.
Yeah, totally.
And he had an amazing experience. And you know, I think for us, it was that I've told the story. My oldest is such a great kid, but he was one of those. I was bamboozled
into believing that your first child is this, you know, type A personality that's driven, that, you know, all the things that you see for first children.
Yeah.
Not so. Not so with this kid. He's a great kid. And but it was just like he and I butted heads.
Mm.
And it was that I had heard somebody had gone and I said, I really think this would be a great experience. Let's see what we can figure out. And even the night before when we were doing registration and I was about to push that button and he was just like, I don't know. And I'm like, this has to be your decision. And he finally said yes. And so I did it. I was like, I could change his mind.
That was so smart to make it his decision. I love that.
But it really was one of those moments where, you know, that it did change him and the others too. One that went to Mexico, one that went to Guatemala. And then we're hoping our third or our fourth or our baby girl will go this year. But it's a crazy experience. So talk about just the logistics and how many countries you're in now, how many trips.
It's wild.
How many kids.
Yeah. It's crazy. So I know sometimes people say to me, so what do you guys do the rest of the year? I'm like, oh, we just watch TV.
Yeah, that's right.
No, it's wild. So this summer we sent 6,000 kids out.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, 52 global locations. We have about 65 people in the office now. It's such a fun office. If you ever come by the Crane Building downtown Salt Lake, come on by.
I need to.
Yeah, it's really fun. We worked really hard to build the culture of HXP. I fundamentally believe that work doesn't have to be a place that's miserable. And so I like to say that I kind of built the company that I wanted to work for. Mm. I feel like, and I also believe really strongly that your culture at the office mirrors out. And so if we wanted the kids that come on our trips to have life-changing experiences, I really believe that our office has to feel like a life-changing place to work. And then we have to be able to teach our trip leaders that they can have and experience life-changing things and that they can do that from their kids. And everything in my past, everything in my story has taught me that, your life changes when you are unapologetically in the service of somebody else. Mm. And so that's HXP. We're unapologetically, our mission is about the kids who go on our trips. The vehicle we use to do that is the humanitarian work that they do. So as a really cool byproduct, we have hundreds of thousands of people that now can go to school or have nutrition centers or, you know, have access to medical centers where they didn't before. But really, our fundamental mission are the teenagers that go on our trips and their lives that are changed as a result. So, but yeah, the logistics are insane. I have an unreal team. I'm literally running this huge nonprofit with like 22-year-olds. I'm the grandma. I'm 49 years old. I'm the grandmother. They constantly have to interpret what the words are that they're saying. But it's such a great culture. And every single person that works in my office, we believe that we are running a world-class organization. We say all the time we want to run the best teenage impact trips in the world. And I'm not talking about our little world. I'm talking about the world. And that's because I believe that Gavin and all the kids, that every single one of the thousands of kids that have come on our trips are worth the best in the world. And so we work really hard to make that happen.
I love it. I just think it's powerful. And yeah, logistically, it's crazy. I'm sure there's always hiccups and things, but I mean, what's your biggest struggle? What's maybe the hardest thing that you have to deal with?
I would say, I think that's a different answer for HXP versus Amy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I think that Amy, I would say my biggest struggle is that I have a bit of a perfectionist tendency. And so as an organization has grown and become quite large, it's hard for me not to want every single tiny thing to be perfect and to be able to understand when it's okay if it's not. I think our struggle with HXP is that as we grow, that there's logistical things that happen all over the world. I mean, we continued to grow during a global pandemic that literally shut the world down. Yeah. And we still grew because people wanted so badly to have these experiences, that as soon as 2021 opened up, we kept going. But this will tell you something about the caliber of my staff. In 2021, we planned 50% more trips than we usually do on the off chance that a place would close and we'd have to reroute them. in 12 weeks, we had to reroute 1,500 kids. And so we ended up using every single one of those extra trips that we had planned just in case. And we were able to have every kid who signed up that year still go on a trip, even if it wasn't the place they originally thought they were going.
Yeah, I had a niece during that time and hers was changed. Yeah,
yeah,
that was great.
Yeah. So that was, and I, again, that goes back to the caliber of the people that work at HXP. These are all kids that could get jobs anywhere else in the world. They're coming out of the best schools and the best, they have options to do whatever, but they've chosen to do this because they believe so. We say, if you want to work here, you have to have a white hot passion. You have to do it for the kids and you have to do it for God, because that's the whole reason that we're around. And that's what we're doing it for. But, you know, the impact that this thing is making, I believe, is going to be generational. Mm-hmm. I think that this is the antidote. The service, I believe, is the antidote. And I feel like you're such a kindred spirit because you're such an incredible example of this. But I believe it is the antidote to the things that we experience as a culture today. The darkness and the confusion and the anxiety and the frustration. Like, service truly is the antidote. And I'm not the first person to say that, but I believe it.
No, I believe it wholeheartedly as well. And of course, that's, you know, Spencer and I have been working on this NGA initiative about Disagree Better. But really, like, the big part that we're doing is service, because, you know, I truly believe, and we've had a couple just past episodes recently about service and serving and volunteerism. And I don't think there's any other way. I think we have to get back to that. And it's funny that we sort of flounder around and can't figure out what's wrong with people. And it's the Facebook, it's the, you know, Instagram, it's the issues that we're seeing with social media and kids and mental health. And we're shocked that our, you know, we've allowed people to do experiments on our kids' brains.
Yes. And please do not give your kids smartphones. I don't care how big that battle gets. Don't give your kids smartphones until I say they're at least they're 16. I'm so sorry to every kid who's listening to this, but don't do it. It's just, I say that as somebody who works with thousands of teenagers.
And somebody who came from Apple and Facebook.
So. Yes, as somebody who's doing penance work right now. I've had so many kids come on my trips whose parents were strict about that, tell me stories about the battles they fought, and then say, I'm so grateful that my mom didn't give me a phone until later.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's powerful. It's, yeah, we've just got to do better. And then, you know, have, I think, for at least personally, you know, I can attest that, you know, it's been a phenomenal experience for kids. It really does help on that trajectory, and it really does help them to look outside of themselves, look outside of their little bubble and their little world, and get proximate to somebody with a different story. I think that's my kids' favorite thing that they come back with, was this little kid that I got to talk to, or this kid that I had
connection.
An experience, you know, a youth in Bolivia that I did, you know, that we were at a dance with or an activity with, that I saw that somehow this faraway place that I knew nothing about, kids are just like me.
Yes,
like, totally. They're still humans. They're having the same type of human experience that I have. And it's powerful to think that there's a world outside of themselves.
Yes.
That's much bigger and much more important than their little worries.
And even to that point, I was going to mention this too. One of the things that I think, as we've gotten bigger, we've become really conscious of is, you know, obviously every family can't afford to send their kids on something like this. And so because it's so powerful and because it's such an impactful thing, we've started to really think about, okay, how can we make this available to kids who aren't necessarily in a position to be able to send kids on this? And it's a tricky thing because so many kids who go on these trips come from middle-class families, but they spend 2 years at their little job at Chick-fil-A earning the money to do this. And I love that when they do that. I always tell parents, even if you can write a check, don't do it, because they're so much more invested when they earn the money themselves. But what I think about a lot too is the kids whose jobs at Chick-fil-A are like keeping the lights on in their family's house. And it's not a luxury to be able to save up for a trip like that. And so this last year, for the first time ever, we started doing scholarships for kids that are, you know, in positions where they just simply this would never cross their mind to be able to do that. And what I love so much about those stories, and we've even had some of your kids from the foster care program that you've been so amazing at impacting. And I love so much that these kids, regardless of their background, come on these trips and they, in their groups, end up with a positive peer group that feels like a family for them. And so they could come from the most wealthy family in the world or from a family that just barely was able to kind of start making it on their own. But they come together and they believe in each other and support each other regardless of where they are. So we're excited to see that program grow as well.
It's powerful. Again, like the other thing that I have been kind of obsessing over lately is the idea of belonging. And yes. I think what this does, what HXP does is, it, like you talked about just barely, the idea of finding connection, finding belonging. I mean, I've just seen it so many times. You talk about social media. I think we as humans, that need is so powerful that we will either find it in love and healthy ways, or we'll find it in hate and really destructive ways. And I just think if we can offer, you know, we collectively as a society can offer kids, adults, everyone, that opportunity to find belonging in places like religious organizations, places like humanitarian organizations, places like this, that is a healthy way that replaces the destructive ways like Facebook and Instagram, where they're where it's just empty, it's just air.
Yeah.
There's nothing substantive about that sense of belonging.
Wow, I think that is, I couldn't tell you how much I agree with that. That is so insightful. I absolutely believe that too. I think we see that in trips all over the world, where the kids, we always tell kids, doesn't matter where you come, what, you know, if you're the popular kid or the whatever, it doesn't matter. But I don't like it when they come with their friends, because when they come by themselves, they can be whoever they want. And then they create this new positive peer group. So we make it really hard for them to sign up with their friends.
I actually love that. And I actually discouraged my kids from you know, connecting with friends to go with them for that reason. Yeah. I just think when I was a kid, I grew up really, we had very little money. Mm-hmm. And I was involved in 4-H, and I was at this leadership. I had the opportunity to participate in this sort of leadership trip to California. I mean, it's just to California from Utah. Yeah. And my mom just, you know, my mom was really into like giving us experiences, even is what she could, to be able to do something that really created that independence and really created that strength of character to do something really scary.
Yeah.
And not have a security of a friend or somebody. So I went on this trip. I got on a bus in Salt Lake City with 50 kids I had never met before. I was terrified.
Oh my gosh.
Absolutely terrified. Yeah. And when I got back from that trip, it was absolute devastation that I had to leave these new friends that I had just made over this week. So that's the experience that I was looking for my kids when I came upon HXP. And so for me, that was that place where my kids were going to have a moment where they're going to do something really terrifying.
Yes.
And they're going to learn some lessons of overcoming that. That's resilience, that, you know, yes, the service. It's all the things.
Totally.
It's, you know, where I, in 4-H, I wasn't really serving anybody, but I had that experience. But this is like the added bonus of you're actually doing something that means, and it's physical. I mean, your kids are out there like
exhausted.
Working. Because again, like I grew up on a farm, like those kind of lessons are really important for me too as a parent. Like,
we say it's the hardest and best summer of your life.
I mean, you're literally like laying bricks and mixing concrete by hand.
Like, no, but I think that's such a perfect story. It's a perfect example. We're really intentional about creating those positive peer groups because we believe that they'll have just as much an impact as a negative peer group would have in terms of the direction that they go. And, you know, for me, especially kind of going back to the initial part of the whole story where I talked about that real fundamental desire to have a family and to be a mother, I now believe, you know, looking back and connecting the dots, looking back, I believe that I chose this. Yeah. Like, I believe this is something that I actually decided to do when, you know, it's kind of like way beyond before I ever sort of showed up in this life, because this is a family. This feels like, and there's like little families happening all over the place. And truthfully, like if we can use those small positive peer groups to help kids learn to love God and learn to love each other, then they come out of that feeling like they have the strength to face whatever big things are coming next. And
I
so
love that.
I feel like I'm like the luckiest girl in the world.
Well, and you're creating leaders in the future, and that's what we need. We need loving, compassionate, caring humans as we go forward.
I hope so.
To be the next leaders, politicians, yes. whatever, so that we can change the trajectory of our
yeah,
country.
And truly, I see it with every single group. Yeah. I mean, these are, I have a real faith in the upcoming generation because I see, frankly, what they're capable of doing. And these kids work hard and they do it for the right reasons.
So and we get out of their way and let them do it.
I love it.
Thank you, Amy. This has just been a delightful conversation.
Oh, what an honor to be here. Thanks so much for the invitation. It was so nice to chat with you.
You can find more information at humanitarianxp.org. Thanks for being a friend.
Two years ago, Americans watched in horror as a crisis unfolded at the Kabul airport.
She was tear gassed and beaten.
Images of thousands desperate to escape Taliban oppression filled our news feeds. More than 80,000 Afghans made it to America. But the story didn't end there.
It was very cold. There was no power, no heat.
Who would help our newest neighbors? I'm Andrea Smartin. In Stranger Becomes Neighbor, you'll hear the stories of some remarkable refugees who left their homes and their dreams behind only to start over from zero.
Their only possession was three blankets.
And you'll meet Americans who stepped up to help them.
You want me to come when you deliver your baby.
What can one person do in the face of an international disaster decades in the making? That's Stranger Becomes Neighbor. Find us at kslpodcast.com. Follow us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else you listen.